House Business and Labor will come to order on this brisk winter day of 2021. It's January 27th. Jordy, could you please take the roll?
Vice Chair Sullivan?
Here.
Representative Curdy?
Here.
Representative Olson?
Here.
Representative Funk?
Here.
Representative Abbott?
Excused.
Representative Whiteman Pena?
Here.
Representative Fitzgerald?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Galloway?
Here.
Representative Logie?
Here.
Representative Seekins-Crowe?
Here.
Representative Durham?
Here.
Representative Marshall?
Here.
Representative Novak?
Here.
Representative Gist?
Here.
Representative Gunderson?
Here.
Representative Zollenkopf?
Here.
Representative Harvey?
Here.
Vice Chair Buttrey?
Here.
Chair Noland?
Here. Looks like we have a quorum. For those of you who are new to the Capitol, we ask you to register at the back of the room if you're testifying, and we're encouraging you to leave your phones on so that my vice chair can call you so that we can have donuts tomorrow. So please leave your phones on so that we can, no, I'm just kidding, please shut your phones off. If you do need to take a call, please step out to give the courtesy to all the good folks that are testifying. I don't see any contentious bills in this today, but I know the former good senator and our good representative who's first up may throw us for a loop here in a minute, but I don't know. But we're looking forward to this first bill, which is House Bill 213. Representative Keene, would you like to open on your bill?
I've lowered the microphone, Representative Buttrey, just for yours, so thank you can hear me well. Thank you, Chairman Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Jim Keene. I represent House District 73 in Butte, and I bring you House Bill 213 for your consideration today. It's a very simple bill as you look on line 17, and it's my understanding, I've worked with the department, they may have an amendment which I support. What I want to reiterate, back in my earlier lifetime in the 1980s, I worked at the Operating Engineer Apprentice Program training heavy equipment operators and mechanic for about 11 years, so I'm very familiar with the apprentice program because it put part of my children through college running that program. And the scary part for me to stand here today is that the apprentices that I've trained are now retiring. So, I mean, you go, wait a minute. It's you're kind of dating myself. But with this, and I want to be, what happened on this situation, as you know, on prevailing wage jobs, a contractor, they come in and make sure he's paying the prevailing wage. Well, this actually happened to my son, who has a company in Butte. And I want to be upfront about that. They came in and inspected him, and he hires apprentices. And I ran an apprentice program for 11 years, and what happened is they said, oh, wait a minute, this apprentice has the wrong date. You're going to have to pay the apprentice full wages for a month. And besides that, we're going to fine you, because that's what's in the rule over at the Labor Department. And throughout the apprentice programs, and I've checked with other ones, the date that you sign up with the sponsor, what happens is it doesn't get turned in sometimes, and it might sit on somebody's desk for a while who's on vacation, and the department said, no, that date doesn't count, the date that it actually showed up in their file, because in order to be apprentice, in order to be paid apprentice wages under federal law, you have to be signed up with a sponsor. And then in Montana, we run an apprentice program under federal guidelines. And the only way you can pay those lower wages is to have a legitimate apprentice program. So what happened, he got signed up. So I said, well, that's not the way it's always been run. And so I was told I'd have to change the law. And I said, I'm up to that. So here I am before you this morning. And the bill is very simple. We want to define, and I want to put it in statute so that this doesn't happen to another contractor. And frankly, the other person, you're a young person, and all of a sudden they've been paying you, now they're going to pay you the high rate for a month and say, no, now you're going back to apprentice. So there's two punishments here, one for the contractor and one for the person. So I'm just trying to clarify it. Once you sign up an apprentice program, that date you sign up with the sponsor, whether you go to work then, or 3 months from now, which sometimes happens, then that's the rate you're going to be paid. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Keene. Are there proponents to House Bill 213? Proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T, representing the Montana AFL-CIO. We just believe that this legislation is going to create some transparency and a level playing field across the board. We urge it to pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is John Forkan, F-O-R-K-A-N. I'm here today representing the Montana State Building Trades Council and Teamsters Local Number 2. And the sponsor made reference to, I too have been involved in apprenticeships all my life. I've served in an apprenticeship. I was served on an apprenticeship committee. And apprenticeships are the foundation of the trade labor movement. And we would stand and ask you to please support this good bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forkan. Are there further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mick Wonnacott, W-O-N-N-A-C-O-T-T, here representing the membership of Labor's Local 1686, and we stand in support with the sponsor of this good bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wonnacott. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Riley McCauley, spelled M-C-C-A-U-L-E-Y. I stand as a proponent on this bill. This gives a good opportunity for Montana to get a good skilled trained workforce. In past I've seen this also be abused, so getting some more strong language against it will definitely help to ensure that we get a good trained workforce in the state and keep it from being abused. So I stand in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCauley.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Point of order.
Could we actually have people slow down a little bit?
Are their names?
Kind of hard to catch first names and then scratch in spelling a quick last names.
We got wink and a nod from this first person, so going forward.
All right, Mr. Please. Chair, members of the committee, my name's John Johnson. That's J-O-H-N, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. I'm a business agent for Local 400 Operating Engineers, and I'm on the apprenticeship board there. We support House Bill 213, as it will protect the apprentices coming into the construction industry, work on the public work projects. House Bill 213 will ensure that the apprentices will be paid the right wages on public work projects. So we urge a yes vote on this. Good bill for the state of Montana. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N. I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Independent Electrical Contractors, also known as the Montana IEC. For those who may not know who the Independent Electrical Contractors are, we are not independent, as you may hear, as it relates to work comp. Independent electrical contractors are often referred to as merit shop contractors, or those who do not subscribe to a collective bargaining agreement. Independent electrical contractors train the large majority of electrical apprentices in the state of Montana. So currently there are 654 registered electrical apprentices in Montana. Independent contractors train 473 of those, or 72%. To complete an electrical apprenticeship, the apprentice must have 8,000 hours of on-the-job training and must complete an approved Department of Labor training program. Not all independent electrical contractors belong to the Montana IEC or train their apprentices through our program. But the Montana IEC currently has classrooms for electrical apprenticeship training in Billings, Bozeman, Great Falls, and Missoula. We also offer the same curriculum online. Independent electrical contractors sign their apprentices up directly with the Department of Labor Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training. At that point, they become registered apprentices. Why is this relevant to the bill? HB 213 states that at the point of signing up to become an apprentice, the apprentice is registered. The union interviews and hires the apprentices there rather than directly through the Department of Labor. And then they send their list on to the Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training. So the point of sign-up becomes very important. The bill, of course, applies to all trades of apprenticeships and not just electrical apprentices. But the electrical apprenticeships make up a large part of the total number of apprentices, and this bill does not affect the majority of those because, remember, we sign up directly with the Bureau, and so then we become registered immediately at that point. However, the Montana IEC believes that this bill puts some common sense into the law for those apprentices that sign up through a union. It removes confusion about when an apprentice becomes registered, which is important for prevailing wage jobs. And this may provide the Montana IEC with some flexibility in the future. So for those reasons, we support this bill. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Morgan. Are there further proponents?
My name is Luke Hoffer. It's H-O-F-F-E-R. I'm with IBW 233 from Helena, Great Falls, and Butte, and we support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffer. Are there further proponents? Any further proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Wade, W-A-D-E, here on behalf of the Montana Contractors Association. They wanted us to just register our support and that it's a clarification that we think will be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Are there further proponents? Further proponents? Seeing none, are there opponents to House Bill 213? Any opponents? Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses? Any informational witnesses? Seeing none, are there questions from the committee? Representative Vice Chair Buttrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the sponsor, please.
Representative Keene.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keene, I'm not sure if this is what the amendment's going to be, but I'm surprised the department's not here to tell us what amendment they want. But so it says apprenticeship wages start. Should it? To me, that's a little bit confusing. That implies that they're going to be getting paid at that moment. I mean, is an amendment or should it be rates are set at the time that they start the sponsorship?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buttrey, yes, I think they wanted to clarify that, and it's when I worked with them, and we were talking about wages, but in order to clarify that language, I would support any amendment that that does that, that spells it out. This is when they're signed up. You don't necessarily have to receive wages at that time. You may not go to work then, but if the paperwork gets delayed or if they do go to work at that time, then that's the date that they're considered apprentice. And I have no problem with taking the wage part out of that. Just to clarify the timeline is that's when they're becoming apprentice, when they go to work and receive the wages, maybe then, and it might be later on as Ms. Morgan stated.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further questions from the committee? Further questions? Seeing no, Representative Durham.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Question for the bill sponsor, Representative Keene.
Representative Keene.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keene, I don't understand the whole progression in rates. Is the prevailing rate a ratio for the apprentice wage? Does that end up being below minimum wage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Durham, no. What it is there's in order to be an apprentice, you are required to have a standard, and it varies from trade to trade. But you have the prevailing wage. But the only way a contractor can pay less than the prevailing wage on a prevailing wage job is to have an apprentice, and it's specific, but it's never below a minimum wage. It's some factor of the prevailing wage, depending upon the craft.
Thank you, Representative Keene.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, would the bill sponsor like to close on his bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask for a due pass on House Bill 213.
Thank you. This concludes the hearing on House Bill 213. Okay, we'll next have the opportunity to hear House Bill number 130. Representative Beattie, would you like to open on your bill, please?
Thank you, Chairman Nolan. Chairman Nolan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Beattie, representative of House District 86, which is comprised of Hamilton and the immediately surrounding area. This morning, I bring for your consideration House Bill 130, a bill that clarifies the role played by the Transportation Commission when highway contracts are procured by means of alternative project delivery methods. But first, allow me to provide some brief background. Alternative project delivery includes such things as design, build, and general contractor construction management contracting. The criteria for award of such contracts include criteria outside of price alone, so that there's no guarantee that the lowest bidder will be awarded the contract. In the case of a GCCM, or General Contracting Construction Manager contracting, criteria for a price proposal and a technical proposal are published in advance of advertisement of request for proposals. Weights are assigned to the price and technical proposals, as well as to an interview, and a cumulative numerical score is assigned to each submission. The bidder with the highest score wins. And I'm sure that's a very brief description of how this particular process works. Now, alternative project delivery, by whatever means, is a complex and sophisticated process that critically relies upon defining the selection criteria carefully and assigning the appropriate weight to each criterion. This often requires judgments outside the realm of pure engineering. In Montana, the Transportation Commission, a body appointed by the governor, is responsible for awarding highway contracts. It is essential that the commission interact early on with the Department of Transportation as selection criteria for any given project are being defined. House Bill 130 requires that the criteria being used for alternative project delivery contracting be approved by the Commission prior to release of requests for qualifications. This step will ensure that, when the Commission awards contracts, as it is statutorily required to do, it has a full understanding of the basis for the recommendations being provided by the Department. This transparency is especially important when the contract is to be awarded to a firm other than the lowest bidder. We must be sure that the additional dollars spent on a project provide commensurate benefits. As I mentioned earlier, alternative project delivery contracting is a complex process. It is successfully implemented only if the selection criteria are properly calibrated. House Bill 130 provides policy that promotes close collaboration between the engineers, read that the Department of Transportation, and the decision makers, the Transportation Commission. This collaboration should lead to effective application of alternative project delivery in the case of highway projects. And a note that I had to append to my opening statement, Chair Nolan, is dated 5:41 a.m. this morning, one of our diligent staff members notified me that an amendment had been prepared and completed for this particular bill. I do not know if it made it into your packets. That amendment addresses the first two technical concerns that you found in the fiscal note. The amendment was actually drafted by, suggested by the Department of Transportation. As to the third concern in the fiscal note, the third technical concern, that's a concern about the absence of a termination date for Section 1. I draw your attention to page 10, line 19 of the bill. That termination language is already in the bill and hence does not need to be included in the amendment. I do, however, because trying to accommodate and ensure that we had offered an amendment to get this bill, you know, ready for your careful consideration and get the amendment in place, I do notice that in the amendment I dated 5:41 a.m. this morning, there may still be a bit of a bone of contention in terminology. Is it GCCM or is it CMGC? They're interchangeable terms within the industry. But in within within the Department of Transportation, one terminology is preferred. Within the Department of Administration, another terminology is preferred. I am not entirely sure that we've resolved that particular problem, but that is not a substantive problem. I think before this committee takes executive action, that particular minor terminology issue could be resolved, and the amendment corrected or an alternative amendment put in that just addresses that terminology issue. And with that, Chairman Noland, I close my opening statement.
Thank you, Representative Beattie. Are there proponents to House Bill 130? Are there proponents to House Bill 130? There's in the audience, we don't have any, so we'll go to online.
Mr. Chair, first I have Greg Jurgensen.
Mr. Jurgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Greg Jurgensen. I live in Chinook, Montana. I have just completed a four-year term as a member of the Montana Transportation Commission representing District 3, which is North Central Montana, basically. Prior to my service on the Transportation Commission, I served 24 years in the Montana Senate. I served 8 years on the Montana Public Service Commission. I served 4 years on the Montana Board of Investments. In my first session of the legislature in 1975, I was assigned to the State Administration Committee. And in those days, the State Administration Committee was that one which was responsible for reviewing and making recommendations to the full Senate on confirmation of governor's appointments to lead up departments and various quasi-judicial boards and committees and commissions that were attached to departments. I learned a lot about the meaning of what those commissions were meant to do and to serve and the purpose that they were to provide in providing oversight over the activities of the committee or of the departments to which they were attached. I believe that given the nomenclature that they're quasi-judicial commissions or committees or councils, and they are confirmed by the Senate, that means there is a special level of oversight that they're expected to perform, and that they need to have the tools to perform that oversight. Of the agency to which they're attached. It was actually, to my great surprise, in my 4 years of experience on the Montana Transportation Commission, that the commission was not given the opportunity, and apparently in this case of design build and construction manager general contractor in the law, not given the tools to do the necessary oversight. These alternative contracting methods replace the sealed competitive bidding process, which was was put into place in Montana's procurement laws back around the turn of the previous century when there was a big scandal about the construction of the Capitol building that was uncovered by Senator Fred Whiteside from the Flathead Valley. And so Montana adopted the procurement laws because of that scandal that became the model in the country. And the sealed bid and competitive bidding was the hallmark of that. And generally, that really does guarantee that there are not the kinds of activities go on that marked various scandals in back in those days on the procurement of these big projects. The difference now, and at one time commissioner from southwestern Montana and I postulated that our commission needed on these alternatives because it is a departure from the sealed bid competitive bidding process that we needed to have a heightened level of review of these projects by the commission before they were approved. As it turns out, we have less of a say in it. In the case of design build, the department decides whether or not to proceed with a design build program, and at the very last minute, and I mean they'll send out their evaluation of the contractors with our packet for a regular meeting, and then at the day of the meeting, typically, or just the day before, they'll give us the part of it that relates to costs. And there's simply not sufficient time to review all that went into particularly the subjective part of it, which is the review of the contractor's proposals. In construction manager, general contractor, the department has decided to proceed with that, they don't ask the commission whether they should proceed with a project using that methodology, and they go all the way through the board of contract without the commission having a say. And I just think this violates every standard of the oversight expectations for these kinds of review committees. And this bill, House Bill 130, is just the first start on giving the transportation commissioner, my successor on this commission, and the others, both the two holdovers and the other new commissioners, an opportunity to make sure that they're able to provide the correct kind of oversight of the Department of Transportation in the award of these enormously expensive contracts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Jurgensen. Are there further proponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Tammy Fisher.
Ms. Fisher. Ms. Fisher, if you're available.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now.
Oh, thank goodness. My apologies. Chairman Nolan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Fisher. I serve on the Montana Transportation Commission currently. I'm a holdover from the last administration. However, it's important to note that my opinions are my own and do not represent those of the commission. In my brief tenure on the Transportation Commission, the overwhelming majority of calls and questions that I have received from constituents are regarding the design, build, and contract manager, general contractor project awards. Your transportation department staff goes to great lengths to inform the contracting community and general public about these types of contracts. However, the commission is not involved in any part of the determination or discussion about the types of projects that would benefit from utilization of the design, build, and CMGC contracting methods. So without the commission's involvement, I was left flat-footed in responding to any concerns raised to me. And because both design, build, and CMGC contracts fell outside of the commission's jurisdiction, it was difficult to engage in meaningful public discussion and assure the public that the commission was fully aware of the design, build, and CMGC process for each project. These issues were not of the department's making, but rather defects in the statutes that created these contracting methods. The current statutes leave virtually all decision-making with the department staff, with minimal commission oversight. I don't think that's what the legislature intended when it created the Transportation Commission, and I would guess it is simply an oversight in the implementation of alternative contracting. The statutes are clear that the commission has jurisdiction over low bid or competitive bid contracting, and the commission determines what projects to place on the running list of projects to be built in Montana. But as of now, the commission does not determine, with the assistance of department staff, which projects would be let via the design, build, and CMGC process. Currently, that decision is left solely with department staff. Yet the design, build, and CMGC projects are the most expensive and complicated projects built in Montana. Two, design, build, and CMGC criteria do have an element of subjectivity that low bid or competitive bid projects don't have, because a team of professionals reviews, weights, and grades proposals, whereas with low bid, any subjectivity is removed from the process. Essentially, the lowest cost and responsive bid wins. So it stands to reason, if the most expensive projects let in Montana don't need commission oversight, then why do the least expensive projects that have virtually no subjectivity attached need commission oversight? This is a quandary that House Bill 130 resolves. I don't believe the legislature intended, when it enacted the statutes authorizing alternate contract delivery, for the commission to be left out of the equation. I say this because the statutes do tell the commission it must approve the stipends awarded to the proposers that aren't awarded the project, yet the commission isn't involved in selecting the project for alternate letting in the first place. So the commission is left to approve a stipend, but it has no idea what the complexities of the project are. And again, that's not the staff's fault. That's a function of how the statutes were written. So this cleans up those issues as well. So instead of the commission playing hokey pokey with alternate contracting, where it has one foot in and one foot out, House Bill 130 makes clear to the public and the legislature that the buck stops at the Transportation Commission. That if there is criticism lodged against the department for the project selected for alternate contracting, then that criticism should rest with the commission and not the staff. And the public can rest assured that the commission is meeting its oversight responsibilities to Montana taxpayers. I applaud Representative Beattie for his efforts in ensuring more transparency in government, which should, in fact, enhance the credibility of the department and these projects as a whole. I am a strong proponent of this bill, and I appreciate your grace and consideration of the same.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher.
Thank you.
Are there further proponents? Any further proponents online? No? Okay. Are there informational witnesses? Any informational witnesses?
Opponents, Mr. Chair.
How about if we go to opponents? Thank you for helping me, Representative Curdy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Wade, W-A-D-E, here on behalf of the Montana Contractors Association, and really the reason we're rising as an opponent, and it's tied in, I think, with this amendment, although we were just became aware of the amendment. We've been concerned that, as drafted, the bill kind of melds some of the various contracting terminology and processes together. And then so that further concerned is about whether or not the CMGC process, which is supposed to be a pilot process, that's supposed to terminate, whether that would somehow unintentionally get extended. And in talking with the sponsor, we understand that's not the intent. And we think maybe the amendments go a long ways to addressing some of our concerns about how the bill's structured and some of the unintended consequences. So we wanted to, I think, stand as an opponent because we need the bill to be amended. We need to understand what those amendments do. And we're look forward to working with the sponsor and the proponents on making sure it's a bill that makes sense and can be implemented. And I think, you know, as we get to the pilot project, we're getting towards the end of that period. I don't know how many projects are even left under that program. So as we move forward, we agree that there should be transparency, accountability. We just want to make sure there's not unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wade. Are there further opponents? Any further opponents? See none. Are there informational witnesses? Any informational witnesses?
Mr. Chair, there is one online, Jake Gettle.
Mr. Gettle.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jake Gettle, G-O-E-T-T-L-E. I'm the construction engineer for the Department of Transportation, and I'm here as an informational witness based on the amendments to this bill. I'm here to answer any questions the committee has regarding the department's processes and or our fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Gettle. Any further informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Any questions from the committee? Representative Logie?
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Jurgensen.
Mr. Jurgensen?
Okay, yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jurgensen, I was just curious if you think with the commission involvement that there, can you put maybe a dollar figure of maybe what it might mean to taxpayers or in a quality of work being done, a savings to the taxpayers by having the commission involved?
It's a matter of with the commission involvement, it's a matter of making sure that the integrity of the process is maintained, and I don't know how I would argue that commission involvement would make it more or less expensive, either in the consummation of any project or in the time and effort it would take on the part of the commission. I think that the commission and the new commission as well are well equipped in their budget and in their time that they have to devote to this to do additional review of these projects and make sure that the subjective portions of them are done with full integrity and fairness to all the contractors that apply for or propose for those projects.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? I have one for, and I'll let whoever wants to answer it, either the sponsor or maybe Mr. Jurgensen. I probably should know the answer to this, but I don't, so I need some clarification on how do we assure that, okay, in the way it reads now that I understand, the low bid gets awarded. It, moving forward, there's an opportunity for maybe the low bid won't get it. Did I misinterpret that? Maybe the sponsor could just answer that quickly. Please.
Chairman Nolan, I will defer to the people on Transportation Commission or the department, but contracting law typically in the state awards contract to the low bidder. But this alternative project delivery contracting has been in place, and actually you'll find it in Title 18 and is available and is used by other agencies and other entities across the state per the, those statutes which are in Title 18. What the topic today, there is an intersection between Title 18 and Title 60. What we're talking about today is a pilot program that is already in place for the Department of Transportation and the Transportation Commission to extend general contractor, construction manager contracting to highway projects. But that terminates, I think, in December 2024. So that's an ongoing pilot program. One of the reasons that I wanted to put this legislation together is should the legislature decide that it wants to end the termination or end the sunset, I wanted to make sure that, the that number one, the pilot was executed in the best possible manner, and that the statute, should the sunset be lifted, be proper. Also, it gets a bit complicated, but Department of Transportation and Transportation Commission in law already have design build built into the law as it exists now. So there is a form of alternative project delivery contracting already in law, which is not part of the pilot program. I know that I gave you an awful lot of background information, but the very short answer to your question is there is contracting being done in this state under which the low bidder is not may not be awarded the contract, and the basis for that is that some other criteria provide benefit that is, to the state that is worth paying the extra amount. The real challenge in any form of alternative project delivery contracting is to make sure that we really understand what that additional benefit is that justifies paying more than we might have to pay otherwise. And that is why the oversight in the case of the highway contracts, the oversight of the Transportation Commission is essential, because change the weighting just a little bit between the technical proposal, the price proposal, and the interview, and you change the results. You can change the results in an incredible a lot. It's an art. It's not strictly a science.
Okay. So, in my further on my question, if I could, when we do, because I was involved in, or I know about this from a long time ago, that low bid was simple. The state, we'd have no issues because there's no opportunity for bargaining, inappropriate, hey, John, you're my brother-in-law. I mean, that all has to be disclosed, and I know that. The bid package process, but I'll help you get this through. That's the fear that happened a long time ago. So when we did away with some of those things and we went to low bid, that was all done. We didn't have any issues, so I don't want to – I'm wondering if we're going to get into that potential frustration, and those of you who have served on that could maybe say absolutely not, there's never been an issue, but I don't want to see something coming down the pipe for that chance.
Chairman Noland, I understand your concerns exactly. Of course, this bill doesn't address the overall decision that's been made by prior legislators that alternative project delivery contracting is permissible but highly regulated by what we do. I would say that one of the ways that we help ensure the integrity of alternative project delivery contracting is to have more eyes on the ball. And so the Transportation Commission, due to its statutory obligation to actually award the contracts, ought to be involved early on in that process. It ought not simply be the department, our engineers, but also people that are, you know, that serve on the Transportation Commission that can understand the trade-offs that are going to be made in order to get to a place where we award contracts to someone other than the lowest bidder. I mean, I can't give you a guarantee that there are absolute safeguards in the integrity of a system. There aren't even absolute safeguards in the integrity of low bid system. But I think that the more transparency we have, the less likely there is to be assaults on the integrity of how we do this.
Thank you. Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, for Ms. Fisher.
Fisher. Ms. Fisher.
Sorry, I'm here. Representative Logie.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fisher, I was wondering, I believe Truck Creek Bridge wasn't that one of the alternative projects, and part of that was the process of deciding who would do the work was because of the time frame the contractor said they could do it in?
Yes, that's correct, Representative Logie. That is my understanding, although the commission was not involved in that decision making.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Curdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Jurgensen, please.
Mr. Jurgensen.
Yes, Representative Curdy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jurgensen, you know, I really appreciate all that the good representative from Hamilton has put into this bill, but I am concerned about oversight. Involved in my previous life in working with contracts. Oversight is really critical. Do you think this bill goes far enough, or do you have any other amendments you would like to make to the bill to strengthen that oversight? Mr.
Well,
Chair.
Quite frankly, Representative Curdy, I don't think this bill goes far enough. I think there are other issues of transparency and authority of the commission that need to be addressed. Some of those need to be addressed by a commission that I hope will wish to be something other than a group of wallflowers who rubber stamp whatever they're brought by the agency. I think this bill is a good start, and because it will, in the early decision making process and choice of projects for this alternative contract, it will have the commission engaged. And so there will be oversight from the beginning, so that what is finally brought to us at the end in the case of design build, or in that is never brought to us in the case of general contractor construction manager, that the commission knows what and where it's going on. I mean, currently there's sometimes a 10-year or even longer time frame from when a project is first proposed to be in the queue for construction. And those projects are frequently out there many, many years. And there are projects that my predecessors on the commission approved and that could now end up being a design build or a general contractor issue for my successor. And my successor then is faced with trying to catch up to what's going on, the decision to go to these alternative contracting isn't even brought to the commission. And I just think that my successor and the other members of the commission cannot do their job properly without this bill as a start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jurgensen, redirect, Mr. Chair.
Redirect to
Mr. Chair for Ms. Fisher.
Ms. Fisher.
There it is. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I may sometime get this right. Representative Curdy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fisher. So you heard my question to Mr. Jurgensen. Would you like to add to that response?
You know, I really don't have a lot to add. I will tell you that all I have heard from department staff is they want an engaged commission. And I would agree with Representative Jurgensen that this is the first step to really full engagement. And to a comment that Representative Logie made, which I very much appreciate his consideration of the costs of getting more involved with having the Transportation Commission getting more involved. I don't see this as an additional cost component, because we are paid as transportation commissioners a whopping $50 a meeting, And I would consider this to be just an additional agenda item on any of those meetings that we have already. We're just involved earlier in the process, and just to create more transparency and less questioning of whether or not a project should be let by competitive bid versus alternate contracting. So I think to your point, Representative Curdy, you know, I've gone through every statute and administrative rule and commission policy that the state of Montana has. And there is some, I think in the next legislative session, there may be some opportunity for cleanup, because there's some areas that the commission, I don't think, needs to be involved in, and other areas where maybe additional oversight would be beneficial to the taxpayers of the state of Montana. So I agree with Commissioner Jurgensen. This is a great start, and I think it helps build a level of trust between the taxpayers and the commission and the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Fisher. And Mr. Chair, just a quick update. I know there was talk about the lowest bid award. When I did do contracting work with the Forest Service, we used what was called the best value contract, which took in a variety of different components to determine the award for a, let's say, an aviation contract. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sullivan.
So, Mr. Chair, question for Mr. Jurgensen, please.
Mr. Jurgensen.
Yes, am I?
Representative Sullivan.
Yeah, you're live. Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jurgensen, I have a basic question. This is not an area of my expertise, so I apologize. Does this bill change who awards the contract at all?
Yes, I think it does. In the case of the general contractor construction manager, I believe that we would have to award the contract, as we do in design build, and in the competitive bidding process. If it doesn't, finally have it be a determination in the case of general contractor of the commission, it ought to. I think that's what empowers the commission to have the effective oversight that's necessary in these kind of circumstances. I would point out that the last design build decision we had was in December, where the part that was based on the proposal, the most points went to the winner of the contract, but they were not the low bidder. And trying for me as a commissioner to ascertain that it was a correct award to make was a little difficult, given the very limited amount of the time and involvement that we had had to understand all of the processes that the department went through to determine which contractors got to even make a proposal, and then the nature of their proposals, much less then figure out how those points somehow equate to points based on the competitive dollar bids that were offered.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
I apologize, Mr. Jurgensen. So for my clarification, this bill, under current statute, Department of Transportation is making the award contract, and this would help the commission weigh in on the award? Or am I close?
Well, in the situation where I, as a commissioner in design build, had to make a decision to make the award on something that was not as clear cut as the sealed competitive bidding process is, I had very short amount of time before our meeting in December to have the information of the processes that the department went through, and then to somehow, and it's very, very late in the process to get the competitive bid, and then try to figure out how the one related to the other to determine what's the best value and to award. And I voted no on that on that. And I think it took the chair of the commission by some surprise that that because I was not satisfied with the involvement of the commission and the amount of information that we had, that I couldn't in good faith tell the taxpayers or the contractors, including those who competed for that contract, that in fact that all was done in the best interest of all. And the best interests of a good completed project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing none, would the bill sponsor like to close on his bill?
Thank you, Chairman Noland, for a good and thoughtful hearing. I'll try to keep this brief since I see your workload is quite high, large today. I want to make it clear that my reading of Montana law provides that highway contracts are to be awarded by the Transportation Commission, and this also includes alternative project delivery contracts, whether they're design build or whether they're GCCM. And I think you can find that by referencing 60-2-112 or 60-2-137. It is possible that some of the wording in that could be strengthened to make it more clear, but I think a reasonable person reading that language would take it that it is the Transportation Commission that is acting on recommendations, ultimately, of the department. But ultimately, it's the Transportation Commission that is awarding the contract, and that is as it should be. If there's something in this bill that if there is a way to strengthen this bill, an amendment in such a way that it makes this crystal clear, I would be for that. But I'm not convinced that that's absolutely necessary. But I think what is necessary is engaging the Transportation Commission early on in this alternative project delivery realm. These are complicated projects, and as I've said a number of times, and it was also reinforced by the proponents, the establishment of criteria is fundamental to this working correctly. In another life, I guess my present life, I work for an engineering firm. We engage with federal clients. And one of the most lucrative contracts we ever had was trying to unscrew up an alternative project delivery project for a major agency on a major project. It wasn't implemented correctly, and the consequence of that was enormous settlements with subcontractors. Our job was to negotiate the claims. This is a hard thing to do. And the more that we engage and the more transparent we are in putting this process together, the better it will be. The one of the promises of alternative project delivery is that it does allow us to look at considerations simply outside of price. Another thing that if executed properly, it should reduce the number of change orders that you see on major contracts, which has a positive fiscal impact. But none of that works if we haven't awarded this and properly thought about the benefits that are accruing from criteria that aren't associated with price. Now, I believe that the opponents' concerns about this bill will be absolutely met once they have a chance to read the amendment. And I want to point out that amendment was brought in, and I vigorously sought to put it in place based upon concerns the Department of Transportation put forward. As I said during my opening, the amendment addresses technical concerns 1 and 2, and technical concern 3, which is the termination date, is already in the bill. You just have to look. It's in the very last section of the bill, which is the way our bills are structured, and that's the way that works. So I think the proponents opponents' concerns, I think, will be met on careful reading. And I was assured by the department that once their technical concerns were in place, that they had no further concerns with this. Finally, with respect to the impact on the state, the fiscal note demonstrates that there will be no costs associated with implementing this change, no costs. And what is not quantified is that ensuring that we do alternative project delivery in the most thoughtful manner possible, the fiscal impact of the state is we'll get better quality projects for the lowest price, the lowest expenditure of public funds. That's the promise of alternative project delivery. We can deliver on that promise if we move forward with House Bill 130. Thank you, Chairman Noland.
Thank you. Jameson, can we conclude the hearing, or do you need to speak first?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jameson Walker here. Just wanted to let everyone know, the committee members, you've heard this before, but members of the audience, that with our new system, the amendments are posted on the website. Just go to ledge.mt.gov and look up your bill. The fiscal note is also on there as well. So anyone looking for the amendment can go there to find it, including the instruction and the amendment in context. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This concludes the hearing on House Bill number 130. Now have the opportunity to hear from one of our own committee members on House Bill number 198. Representative Harvey, would you open on your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members, Representative Derek Harvey out of House District 74, which is all of Uptown Butte. Today I bring you a bill that really is summarized in the title, and that's an act generally revising laws related to worker compensation, burial expenses, and increasing that benefit going forward. So as you'll see on page 1, line number 16, this bill looks to increase the burial benefit for a worker that dies in the course of work from $4,000 up to $10,000. And then you'll see in subsection 2, starting on line 18, every 5 years, this will give the department the task of increasing this off of the CPI or the Consumer Price Index. So when we look at this bill, one of the concerns that I thought would be posed by the committee, and so I wanted to bring some information forward, is how frequent do these claims happen? And so over the last 5 years, if we do a 5-year look back, claims that have been submitted for this current $4,000 burial expense, there's been 47 in the last 5 years. So if you look at that, that's less than 10 a year on average. So with this increase, that's less than $100,000 a year. So by no means is this going to break the bank of our worker comp providers. So you may ask why this bill is needed. And we really have to look back at what is the purpose of the workers' comp system. And the workers' comp system was set up to make employees or workers whole if they're injured on the job. Whether that's getting that employee back to work, whether that's compensating them and giving them the care they need if they can't come back to work, and ultimately if an employee dies on the job, it's laying them to rest in the manner that they wished. So to make whole, this bill needs to take place so we can get up to the current level of the burial expenses. And we feel that the $10,000 will cover that, and then this second section will keep us on pace in the future so the legislature isn't having to come back and increase this. So hopefully this will be a fix for the future. So with that, we have some folks that would like to speak more on this, and I will see you at the closing.
Thank you, Representative Harvey. Are there proponents to House Bill 198?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Iverson, Iverson. Before you today, representing the Independent Insurance Agents of Montana. I was also asked to throw in a Me Too for the Montana Logging Association. He was unable to make it today. I think a couple important things to note about this bill. As we know, costs go up over time. The last time this was increased was 1999, billed by Fred Thomas. And at that time, it was considered just a cleanup bill, increasing it from $1,400 to $4,000. I think another thing that's important about this insurance, if you think about it from an employer's point of view, they pay for this coverage and they think they have coverage. They know they have a death benefit, but it's unlikely most employers know what that death benefit is. And as it's currently set, it's not at a level that's going to cover the costs associated with burying an employee who dies in the line of work. And so this is getting people the coverage they thought they were already purchasing. And I think what's most important about this, it's not extravagant. We're talking about $10,000 here. This is not a fancy funeral. This is get the job done. It's not extravagant. It's just the decent thing to do. So with that, we ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Iverson. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T, representing the Montana AFL-CIO. I really don't have much to add on top of what the sponsor and the previous proponent just said. We think this is the right thing to do for all workers in Montana, union, non-union, so we urge it to pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Joel Wirth, W-O-R-T-H. I am a carpenter representative out of Butte, Montana. I speak in favor of this bill not only as a carpenter representative but also as a single father. No one wants their children to have to stress about how they will be able to afford a funeral if something were to happen to you on the job. And I ask that you support this bill, 198. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wirth. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is John Forkan, F-O-R-K-A-N. I'm here today representing the Montana State Building and Construction Trades Council and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local Number 2. We rise in support of this. As a previous speaker talked about, when a family loses a wage earner, turns that whole family and all their lives upside down, and the least they could do is give the worker the dignity to be properly buried. And we would ask your support on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forkan. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mick Wonnacott, W-O-N-N-A-C-O-T-T, here representing the Labor's Local membership of 1686. And as already said, Labor's Local 1686 stands in support with the sponsor on HB 198. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Honecker. Are there further proponents?
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Smith. I am here representing the Montana Police Protective Association. I'm also here representing the Montana Law Enforcement Museum. I'm a retired police officer with over 24 years of experience working in Sydney, Lewistown, and Great Falls. Unfortunately, I've had the duty of being involved in some line of duty deaths of our members. We would support this change and this continued increase over the years, as when a family goes through this situation, it's very traumatic, and anything that we can do to help, we support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rhonda Wiggers, W-I-G-G-E-R-S, on behalf of the NFIB. Most of our members are small businesses. The majority of them have less than 10 employees. When they lose an employee, they've lost a family member. They think this is paid for with their work comp. Turns out that it isn't fully paid for. And now between the employer and the family, they're struggling. They've not only lost a family member, they're now also needing to come up with more money to pay for the funeral. We think this is right. I would normally stand before you and oppose anything that we thought was raising our work comp fees. But look, if you take a look at the fiscal note and ask, thankfully, this doesn't happen very often. So there's very few of these a year, and it's not a huge increase, and we've been told it will not raise our rates. So this is the right thing to do at literally no cost to the employers.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggers. Further proponents?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Johnson. That's J-O-H-N, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. And now I'm with the Operating Engineers Business Agent, and we support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Further proponents?
Good morning, Chairman Nolan, Vice Chair Buttrey, and Vice Chair Sullivan, committee members. I'm Eric Anderson, E-R-I-C-A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. Today I'm representing Local 190, Teamsters Local 190 in Billings, and I would like to go on the record of thanking Representative Harvey for doing the work of bringing this to you, and I want to thank you for your consideration, and we are in support of this effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Jack McBroom, M-C-B-R-O-O-M. I am the business manager for IBEW Local 233. We have 340 families that we take care of, Great Falls, Helena, and Butte, and all the surrounding areas. We are in, we agree with this bill, and like the others, we are very thankful that this was brought forward. It's something that needs to be done. It's not a union or a non-union thing. It's the decent thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McBroom. Are there further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carter Marsh, M-A-R-S-H. I'm here on behalf of the Montana State Council Professional Firefighters, Montana Firefighters Association. I'm currently a firefighter paramedic in Great Falls, and we stand in support of this legislation, and we thank Representative Harvey for bringing it to the attention. We would urge you to pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Are there further proponents? Any further proponents in the room or in the hall? See none. Proponents online.
Mr. Chair, first up is Jeremy Norby.
Mr. Norby.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Norby, N-O-R-B-Y. My family has a farming and ranching operation in Sydney, Montana, or Eastern Montana. And I appreciate Mr. Harvey carrying this bill. Our family, we lost an employee in July of this year, young individual, 24 years old, no dependents, got killed in a railroad accident driving one of our trucks, and his family goes down to the funeral home to start to figure out the arrangements to take care of him, and the funeral director says, well, your benefit from your workers' compensation policy pays $4,000. Previous to that, this year, my father got also killed in a railroad accident, and we, as a family, knew what that bill was going to be, and it was far more than $4,000. So as an employer, you know, obviously we felt the obligation to step in and help that family take care and bury their son. And due to the fact that he is a single person, no dependents, that's the only benefit he's going to get from work comp, and literally had the worst thing happen to you at work that can happen, lost his life. And that is where it tapped out. We obviously are strongly proponents of this bill, feel that it's just vital. You pay for an indemnification product to take care of you and your employees when they're working for you. And, you know, legislatively, it at least needs to provide that benefit for that individual and his family. And so, obviously, we stand very strongly in proponents, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Norby. Next online proponent.
Peter Strauss.
Mr. Strauss.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this time. This is my first time in front of the committee, so I will provide a brief introduction. I represent the Montana Self-Insurers Association. We are employers in Montana, and self-insured employers employ over 100,000 Montanans throughout the state. We also are supportive of this bill and appreciate Representative Harvey bringing it up and Mr. Norby bringing it to him. With this change, Montana will move from the second lowest burial benefit in this country to among the highest, although still within absolutely acceptable ranges for the costs of the system. We will join 20 other states at this level. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We support the bill. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Next. Do we have any further proponents online? We do.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Al Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Al Smith, Montana Trial Lawyers Association. Just would add just one thing. This is just a very small impact, if any, to the entire work comp system, but it's a huge impact for the families that are affected by this, and we'd urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any further online proponents? None. Are there opponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Wade, W-A-D-E, here on behalf of the Montana Contractors Compensation Fund and the Montana Municipal Interlocal Authority. In our objection is not to the increase in benefit contained in the new section sub 1. We support that increase. Our objection is to the new subsection 2, where you have a rulemaking authority granted to the department based upon a CPI, because then that kind of gets them away from any legislative oversight. I'd also point out that there's some inconsistency in the first sentences. The department shall, through rule, adjust it based upon CPI. Then the last sentence is a blanket kind of sentence that just grants them making rules plural related to this. So we think if you just got rid of two, make sure the legislature keeps their oversight and pass the increased benefit, it'd be acceptable. Thank you.
The further opponents.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Bob Allum, A-L-L-U-M. I live in Belgrade. I'm currently a participant in the Montana State Fund Workers' Comp, and I come to speak against this because of the studies I've been doing on, and I will speak only to Montana State Fund. I have no experience with plans 1 and 2, the self-insured, or the regular insurance companies, but only Montana State Fund. When Montana State Fund was redesigned in 1987 and 1989, virtually every proponent of the new system argued to reduce litigation, reduce the cost, and improve the benefits for the worker. This bill does none of that. What I want to do is address it in the four areas that all the proponents of the new Montana State Fund gave. They said the number one way to stop litigation is write bills that are not ambiguous. If you look at this bill, it wants $10,000 maximum, no minimum, maximum, and it must be on reasonable burial expenses. I admit ignorance as to the cost of a burial in Montana at this point in time because I don't hope my family will have to use it very shortly. But I don't expect the cost of burial in Sydney or in Broadus to be the same as it is in Missoula or in Helena. Thus, you leave it open to what is a reasonable burial expense. The next issue was, who administers it? If you're administering it through the Montana State Fund, there is no criteria for what's a reasonable expenditure. I would hope that this bill would go back and we could determine what a reasonable absolute figure is today in the bill and state this is the benefit. You've heard how few people can access or have access to this benefit in the last 5 years. What's the worst case scenario? If a fixed benefit is allotted for Missoula and Helena and is applied in Broadus, assume that they want cremated and the cost of cremation is $500 with the urn. So they walk away with certain amount of money, the family does, not defined in the actual workers' compensation. But is that even worth considering when they've just lost a loved one? The cost of the burial and the cost of peace of mind of knowing a specific amount gets to be more important than having to fight for it. Because there's no definition in this bill as to who will administer it in Montana State Fund, you then ask for who's going to enforce it. Well, we notice the bill says it's going to go to the Department of Labor and Industry. The only problem is the legislature in 39-71-2315 states in subsection 2, the board is vested with full power, authority, and jurisdiction over state fund. There is no jurisdiction over state fund by the Department of Labor. So when you get to them, it even gets worse, because if you look, and it references except in 39-71-2375, and 2375 in section 3A, it says the state fund is not subject to subsection 6, any assessment of punitive or exemplary damages. So there is no liability for Montana State Fund saying, we think that $500 is sufficient burial fund because you can get them cremated and get an urn for that price. So what you've got going with this bill is a total abrogation of this committee and this legislature's actual function. You've already heard it brought up by the contractors board. When you come to subsection 2 in the rulemaking, Article 3, Section 1 of the Montana Constitution is a separation of powers clause. The courts have held that if you give the rulemaking decision to someone who is not a legislator, such as Montana State Fund, you're in violation of that section. I would propose, as a recipient of this type of benefit, that instead this bill be redrafted, figure out what a reasonable cost for burial is in the state of Montana today, set a positive figure at that amount, and then the Department of Labor and Industry be provided with, they shall increase every 5 years the cost of living to that amount. It doesn't affect the problems with the state of Montana and Montana State Fund, but at least it would address the other two. In sum, this bill reminds me of the guy who bought a brand new vehicle. He loved that vehicle. The only problem is with age, it started to rust and it started to not perform as well. So he put a brand new paint job on it and new mag wheels, chrome wheels, decked it out. It looked beautiful, but he didn't change the engine or the powertrain. So the performance didn't increase, but it looked good. As he saw more rust, he kept putting more paint on it. Till ultimately, he had a bunch of rust out in the field that couldn't move because he has so much paint on it, it couldn't carry the weight of the paint. That's what this bill does. It keeps adding additional problems for those of us who received the benefits supposedly in good faith from Montana State Fund, but it allows no control over Montana State Fund on whether they'll even give those to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ollum. Are there any further opponents? Any further opponents? Any online opponents? No. Okay. Any informational witnesses? We had a couple.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chris Puyer, that's spelled P as in Paul, U-Y-E-A-R, here today on behalf of the Montana Funeral Directors Association. MFDA represents professionals in the death care industry across the state, and we were asked to poll our members prior to this hearing on the average cost of a burial in Montana. According to that poll, it came in at roughly $11,000. We don't have a position on the legislation, but just wanted to provide that information to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Puryear. Are there further informational witnesses? online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Eric. Yes, Eric Strauss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Strauss, S-T-R-A-U-S-S. I'm the administrator for the Employment Relations Division in the Department of Labor and Industry. We have regulatory responsibilities in and around benefits and claims in the workers' compensation system, and also collect a lot of data with various components of the system. So I'm available to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss. Do we have one more informational witness online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Ethan Heverly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ethan Heverly with Montana State Fund. I'm the Director of Government and Community Relations, and I'm here to try to answer any questions that you may.
Thank you, Mr. Heverly. Seeing no further informational witnesses? Seeing none? Questions from the committee? We were doing lots of writing, so Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. I kind of have to concur with Mr. Allman. My mind, and I don't know who would like to address this, but I guess maybe one of our informational witnesses. It seems to me that we would be better off if we could find a way to tie the CPI every year. Would that be a problem? I guess I would direct this towards our last informational witness, Mr. Heberle. Would it make sense? Would it be that much trouble to just tie this to the CPI every year and eliminate a lot of this language so that we don't have the issues that were brought up by one of the opponents?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, I think that question is better suited for Mr. Strauss as his department works on that portion.
Thank you. Redirect.
Redirect to Mr. Strauss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Galloway, yes, we already have processes in place that do something similar for other programs, for example, minimum wage or the average weekly wage in the workers' compensation system, where we have an annual review process applying CPI increases to those rates. So from our perspective, annual would actually be easier. It would just be easier for us to incorporate that on an annual basis. So that's certainly something that we could adopt if that was the pleasure of the committee. Thank you.
Follow up. Question for the sponsor.
Representative Harvey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway.
Representative Harvey, would you entertain a motion to modify or amend this to go along those lines to make a better bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, absolutely. We kind of put the 5 years in there hoping for it not to be as burdensome, but hearing from Mr. Strauss saying that it would actually be easier on an annual basis, absolutely. We just want to get this up to a level that's sufficient to cover the costs. And Mr. Chairman, I was asked by Mr. Iverson, he has some statistics he forgot to pass out, if I could do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Harvey. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, with this handout, if I could just give a brief explanation, because there'll be some difference in the numbers, and I just wanted to clear that up. On the front side where you see this chart here, this is all of the claims that have been submitted to workers' comp back to 1999. So these are actually claims that have been submitted and paid out. And then if you look on the back side, this long graph, this is actually on-the-job injuries that resulted in death all the way back to 1991. And the difference in those numbers are the deaths that happened to where those individuals did not have workers' comp coverage. So that's the difference in those numbers there.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Gunderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Pyer.
I'm sorry, who again?
Puryear.
Puryear. Puryear.
Puryear.
You could come back in. There we go.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I did not hear who asked the question.
Representative Gunderson has a question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Puryear, and you probably don't have this number off the top of your head, and it's probably something you're going to have to supply us, but has the cost, the average cost of a funeral followed CPI over the last 10 years?
That's an excellent question, Representative Gunderson. Like any other product, the cost of a funeral has increased over time. However, I don't know if it's tracked exactly. I'll do my best to gather that information for you.
If you could. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Not to be morbid, I guess, but I guess for my own information, what entails an average funeral? Not that I'm looking forward to it, but I just get my head wrapped around it.
Certainly. Well, the first thing that I would say is the average cost of a funeral is highly variable. It's typically driven by, you know, the desires of the family. But generally, you know, we're talking about the, you know, the cost of the casket, the cost of the embalming, the music, any pictures that are associated with the proceeding. It's kind of a beginning to end cost all in.
And one follow-up.
A follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pyer, is there any way to come up with a negotiated price for a, you know, not the golden casket, but not the wooden one, but something right in the middle? Or, you know, can we find something that we could work with to where we've got a known cost?
Representative, I'd have to get back to you on that. You know, these are competitive businesses, so they do compete among their peers. So I don't know that it would necessarily work to provide a fixed price. I think the goal of the legislation here is sound, which is just to let families know what they have to work with and provide them with a little bit more to work with than they currently have. And then ultimately it would be up to the family to kind of live within that budget or to decide whether or not they wanted to go beyond that expenditure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Galloway, did you get all your questions answered?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think I did.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a quick question for Mr. Iverson.
Mr. Iverson, this is a quick question for you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you. I actually can't see you. It's unfortunate, but
well, I look good today.
That's debatable.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Iverson, and this is maybe a question for any of the agents who spoke about the low cost that this is actually not going to affect the price of insurance, of work comp insurance. That's negligible, and so we had an opponent mention that it seems like it would be easier on everyone if there was just a set, let's say a set $10,000 benefit, since the average funeral was considered to be $11,000. I think the average means that some people do less and some people do more. But if you were to do a set benefit, would that actually be cheaper for work comp insurance companies and private insurers because of not having all of the paperwork and the staff time involved? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I don't know if I'm in the best position to talk about the paperwork burden, but I would say what I like about this bill is it it gives the money to the family and lets the family choose what they want to do. You know, a lot of different people have different cultural desires at the time of death, and this provides that flexibility that I think is really fair to those families at that time.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, my question really is for anybody in the room who would be able to speak to whether or not having a set average benefit, i.e. the $10,000 or if it's $11,000 next year, the set benefit, whether that would be a negligible cost as well as having the reasonable flexibility of, but then having to do all the paperwork and the staff time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who to answer that question, who would want to answer it. Oh, I see that Mr. Nordby has his hand up. Maybe he would be willing to answer that question.
Does anybody want to?
Mr. Nordby,
I see
online.
That. I see that.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so we have two people. So we'll have Mr. Nordby first, and then if Mr.
Representative Olson, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess what I would say from the having the set benefit basis is that that time is very stressful for the family members. And so I also own an insurance agency in Sydney, and I can speak to the claims process can be drawn out if there's not a defined benefit. And so the advantage of having that is when they go to the funeral home the day after that loved one has passed, the funeral director can sit there and say, okay, your death benefit's going to pay $10,000, $11,000, $12,000. Here is our package deals. You know, this is how it's laid out. This is the cost of a casket. This is what, you know, it's going to cost you to rent whatever facility you'd like to host your event at. And so the family members can sit there and make a plan for how they'd like to allocate that those costs across the board. Without a defined benefit, you know, you would pick whatever funeral you want, would have to submit to the insurance company. They would go to a claims handler, and that person would evaluate the validity of those claims. I would say that more than likely it would be paid, but it leaves a gray area. And one of the nice things about having black and white answers for a family at a time like that is that their whole world has just been upheaval, and it's very difficult for them. So the less gray area, the better, in my opinion, for them. That's more of an opinion than a fact, but just in my experience with insurance claims, you know, the more defined benefit you have, the easier it is to work with an insured to give them expectations of what it's going to look like.
Thank you, Mr. Nordby. Mr. Chair, that answers my question. Unless someone has something else they'd like to answer to the question, that would be fine with me as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
She got her question answered. So.
Well, but it doesn't really address the people.
Well,
the point being,
if we give you 2 minutes,
I don't even need that. It comes down very simple. If you deal with Montana State Fund, the minute it goes into negotiations and you hire an attorney to represent you, you lose 20% by contract, which has been approved by the state. So if you give $10,000 that's negotiated with Montana State Fund, you just cut that in family's recipients to $8,000. If you had a fixed amount, you don't put the family either through the emotional stress or give a gravy train to attorneys who just simply make phone calls to their friends in the state. So I would say from my perspective, as a recipient of these and a potential sooner than most of you, I would like my family to know exactly what they're going to receive and not have to negotiate and hire attorneys and go through the entire ordeal with Montana State Fund.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Nolan, Chair Nolan. Question for Mr. Strauss again.
Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strauss, in hearing testimony here, my mind's trying to scramble to find some good solutions for the opponent and the proponents. And in my mind, wouldn't it be simple enough for us to eliminate these rules and things that are referenced in here and go to an actual schedule that we could create with the funeral home directors, that you actually had a schedule and then use the CPI to create, okay, if they pick this, it's that. If they pick this, it's that. And we could cover all these options in a pretty simple fashion. Do you think that'd be possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative, without seeing the details of that specific proposal, it's hard to answer, but we have a variety of different ways by which we come to conclusions, and the rules process is generally a pretty good way at exploring those and ultimately coming to a conclusion that's satisfactory to the parties. So we're willing and able to do whatever you guys see as best.
Thank you. Redirect to the sponsor.
Representative Harvey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galloway, if you wouldn't mind just repeating so I can refresh that in my
you
mind
bet.
There.
So. Mr. Chair, Representative Harvey, I guess my mind's just envisioning a solution. I've heard good testimony from the opponent there that makes sense. We don't want a hassle for these families, but yet we want to give them the fairest benefits we can. I know, having worked with work comp and different other insurances out, you know, that cover work comp besides the state, it can get to be a hassle. And of course, like it's been testified, if you have to hire an attorney now, all of a sudden you're losing a portion of that. In this, in my mind, being in business, funeral directors usually have a schedule of things that you can choose from. And I can't see why we can't develop that schedule, put it in statute, these are the things. And then all the department has to do then is every year tie those to CPI. And we have a crystal clear cut, here's what you can get, you know, so that it's, you know, there's just, we don't have this problem. Because even right now, if we pass this in my vision, we could be under or over. There's so many variables in doing a funeral that we're kind of taking the gunshot approach. And I feel with the, if you get the wrong person adjusting your case, no offense to anyone, but it could become a nightmare for a family. So that would be my proposal, to see if we couldn't amend this, if you would be willing to work with that and the department's on board to try to, that we could take this and make it a concrete, clear cut and something that keeps current instead of the 5 year we're looking at. Like he early testified, he could do look at this every year and we'd stay current. That would just be my thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, I'm on board to make it right for these folks. I feel that if we can go over 10,000 and that's agreeable to the folks, and we do it in a certain set of parameters and lay out what this benefit will be, I'm definitely willing to work on that. I do feel that this is a system that's in place and has been working. If you look at the chart of the claims, it's not always the full benefit of the $4,000 currently that's being paid back. If you look at 2019, it said that there's 9 claims filed, but only $33,890 paid out, to where if that would have been the full amount, it would have been $36,000 even. So this is a claim that's being submitted and paid out for the costs. And then, as we see in 2020, the full $4,000 was paid out, more than likely because that burial probably far exceeded that $4,000. But yes, it's in the hands of the committee now, and I'm willing to work to make this right for our families that fall on this hard circumstance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Buttry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Buttry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Harvey, so you've been here a long time as a legislator, so I'm just wondering your opinion. If we did go with some schedule of payment, would that, in your opinion, require the legislature every session to come in and readdress this section of law?
That is a fear of mine with moving down that path. I don't want this to be burdensome on any side. I do feel that if we don't make it clear enough and set it on its own course, that we will have to address this every legislative session.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, a question for Mr. Heverly.
Mr. Heverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Buttrey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heverly, so you're from the state fund, and you're hearing discussion of us setting an actual rate versus a maximum. I just wonder if you can tell us how a work comp insurer such as a state fund, what you do internal, the processes when the code is like it is today where it says maximum 4,000. I'm sure you must have some inner workings that decide how you pay and what you pay. What's your thought? How does that work? And what's your thought about us coming up with a static number?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buttrey, thank you for the question. I do have thoughts on that. So my thoughts are you establish the benefit level and we pay it. The reference to a couple of, if I can clarify a couple of comments that were made. First of all, in most cases that I'm aware of, we actually pay directly to the funeral provider, not to the families. Regarding the full benefit payment amount, there was somebody mentioned a discrepancy between if we had paid at the full benefit level versus what was actually paid. And I think, without seeing those numbers, what is probably the case there is it is the benefit level is a maximum. So people can come in, a funeral cost can come in below the maximum. It doesn't mean that it is, if you have three funerals at $10,000 a pop or at each, it doesn't mean that the payment is going to be $30,000. One may come in at $7,000, or, you know, in the case of COVID, we've had a number of we've seen a number of deaths, not state fund. I just mean generally speaking, where folks don't have services during COVID, and so those costs are cheaper. And so, and I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chair, Representative Buttrey.
That'll do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gunderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eberle.
Mr. Eberle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Eberle, we were given a handout that gives us from 1999 to 2020 the number of claims and then the sum of the funeral expenses. Are you familiar with that? Or,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunderson, I am not.
Redirect?
Redirect to?
To the sponsor.
Representative Harvey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harvey, where did this graph come from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunderson, this was given to me by Mr. Iverson, but I believe he had worked with the Department of Labor to pull these statistics, so maybe a redirect to Mr. Strauss would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair, please.
Redirect to Mr. Strauss. Do you have that information in that graph?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Gunderson, yes, I'm familiar with that data. I did provide it to Mr. Iverson.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Strauss, I did a little just quick math, and I guess I'm really fuzzy on what this is telling me. If I look at 1999, there were 18 claims for the sum of $54,615. That averages out about $3,000 per claim. And then if I go through a few months, the most I'm seeing is $3,600 as an average. And if I jump up to about 2016... it jumps up to $3,773 The next year it drops down to 3,270. The next year is approximately the same. And then in 2019, it's 3,765. So we're already working with not exceeding $4,000. Why would we want to jump it clear up to $10,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson, I don't know that I can necessarily speak to what the appropriate level is. The data that's reported to us comes through from the insurers, so I don't necessarily know their practices and what types of costs are being reimbursed. I don't know that it necessarily covers the entire cost of a funeral. So those would be questions that the details would be available from the insurers. We just get reported to us the high level data, and that's what's reported in that chart.
Follow up. So, Mr. Strauss, what you're saying then is that data should be available through work comp?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson, I would suspect that the actual reimbursements that were given in those particular claims would probably be available from the insurers. We don't get that level of detail at the department.
Okay, thank you, sir. Okay. Redirect?
Redirect to?
Somebody from work comp.
Mr. Heverly or somebody else?
Probably Mr. Heberling.
Heverly with an H.
Mr. Heverly, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson, yes, I think without seeing the document, I think what you're referring to is exactly what I was attempting to explain a moment ago. It's likely due to expenses coming in under the cap. And so, perhaps somebody doesn't have a service, or perhaps they opt for a cremation as opposed to a casket and a service. That's, again, without seeing the document, that's my best guess.
And one last question.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, one last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. Mr. Heverly, could you supply us with that data so we can kind of compare if jumping from the current 4,000 to a not exceeding 10,000 would be appropriate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunderson, only as it applies to Montana State Fund. Just as a reminder, we are Plan 3. Plans 1 and 2 have their own data as well. For instance, over the last 3 years, we've seen an average of 5 of these claims a year. And so it's not the complete picture that you're requesting.
Thank you, Mr. Eberle. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Further questions? See none. Would the bill sponsor like to close on his bill?
Mr. Chairman, fellow members of the committee, thank you for the great hearing. In our discussion today, I'm hearing one commonality is that we're all on board. We want to make sure that we're doing the right thing for these families that fall on these hard times. And with the intent of this bill to increase it to the $10,000, I view it as we are just extending the budget for these families. As we look at the past and we see the differences in these claims, these circumstances happen out of the blue and unknown. And when many of these families, I am sure, went to the funeral home, they went in and said that they had a $4,000 budget. And the funeral home worked within that budget for them. But as Mr. Norby spoke, and I really need to thank him because he was one of the main ones that brought this issue to light, to do what the family had wished or that person had wished for their proper burial to make them whole, it exceeded that $4,000 by quite a bit. So with this bill, I'm just asking that we extend that budget so when the families fall on these unexpected hard times, they can go in and know that they have a little bit more in their pocket to work with. This really is something that I feel strongly about because we need to make sure that these families are taken care of at least on this minimal level. And when we talk about $10,000 in the workers' comp system, more than likely if you stub your toe or crush your toe, drop a weight on your toe at work, and you go in and you have x-rays and you get a tetanus shot, it's more than likely going to cost more than $10,000. And all we're asking for here is $10,000 to lay these folks to rest in the manner that they have wanted. So I thank the committee for a great hearing. I urge a due pass, and thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Representative Harvey. This concludes the hearing on House Bill number 198. Do we need a minute for people to come in, or are they already in?
I believe we're okay.
Okay. We'll next have the hearing on House Bill number 199. Representative Harvey, would you like to open on your bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, fellow members of the committee, once again, Representative Derek Harvey out of House District 74 in Butte. Spelling of my last name is H-A-R-V-E-Y. Today I bring you House Bill 99, which was brought forward by the Labor Management Advisory Council. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I have some handouts to help explain this.
Please.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, with some new faces in the committee this year, we have, I'd like to just go a little bit into what the Labor Management Advisory Council is, and it's often referred to as LMAC. So the Department of Labor and Industries Employment Relation Division provides support to the LMAC, or the Labor Management Advisory Council, and this council is charged with evaluating opportunities to improve the workers' comp system here in the state. It's composed of members representing both labor and management, hence the name. So in order for the LMAC committee to endorse any improvement, it requires a majority vote out of that council. And so this bill that I'm bringing you today came as a result of the work done by the LMAC committee between 2019 and 2020. And they unanimously brought forward these three changes. And so the first change you'll see in House Bill 199 happens on page 1, line 22 through 25. And so what this does, it allows the department to provide information on non-statutory benefits to injured workers. There are many programs, scholarships, that are available to injured workers and their families, but because they're not administered by the department, our current statute restricts them from sharing this information with the injured worker. So this bill would change that and allow them to offer strictly this information to these injured workers. Next change in House Bill 199 occurs on page 3, line 24 through 28. And so in the workers' comp system, at 60 months, medical benefits automatically enclose unless the benefit allows the worker to stay at work or return to work. There's a process that allows workers to petition to have their claim reopened. And during that petition, both sides provide medical records to support or deny that petition. So sometimes there's not a dispute between the injured worker and the worker comp provider. And so this change that occurs on line 24 and 28 of page 3 just says that if there's not a dispute, neither side would have to go through the burdensome task of presenting that medical information. So this is just if both sides agree, they can reopen the claim without that burdensome exchange of that medical information. And then the last change, which is a little harder to find, is on page 4, line 6 through 8, and this strictly repeals a section of code. And so Plan 2, which is our private insurers, are required to provide a security deposit to the department in the event of a bankruptcy or inability to pay out the liabilities that they have. So in this specific group, in Plan 2, all private insurers also pay into the Western the guarantee fund. So for that exact same purpose of covering the bankruptcy or the inability to pay those liabilities. So by repealing this section, this just means that those private insurers don't have to pay double, because really those two operations are doing the same thing. So with that, Mr. Chair, I believe there's a few folks to speak more on this, and I'll see you at the closing.
Are there proponents to House Bill 199?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Wade, WADE. I believe this is the last bill today that I'll be up here. So,
Thank you.
We urge your support. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Contractors Compensation Fund and the Montana Municipal Interlocal Authority. I think Representative Harvey did a great job of explaining the bill. We think it's a good bill, and we'd urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T, representing the Montana AFL-CIO. We also sit on LMAC and fully support the collaborative efforts that went into this bill. We especially like the new language on Section 3, which we think will streamline the process in order to make sure an injured worker gets the care they need, so we'd ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I just, as I spoke to the chairman this morning, I just wanted to note for the record that I actually attended 3 separate hearings in your committee today, and I was a proponent on all 3 of them. So I just wanted to thank you for that opportunity.
I think that needs to be noted.
Okay. I'm here today representing the Montana State Building and Construction Trades Council and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and we rise in support of this bill. It's terrible when one of our workers gets injured on the job, but there are also a lot of red tape and stuff they run into trying to get healed up and be able to get back in the workforce, and we think that this is a good step forward to remedying that, and we would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forkin. Are there other proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carter Marsh, M-A-R-S-H. I'm here for the Montana State Council of Professional Firefighters. And I'm a current firefighter paramedic in Great Falls. A year and a half ago, myself and my crew were ran over by an impaired driver while we were in the line of duty. And we all got injured pretty bad, and we're lucky that that previous bill didn't have to apply to us. But these injuries are something we're going to have to deal with for the rest of our lives. And even though it took me 8 months to get back on the job, and it's crucial that we provide as much streamlined efficiencies as we can in workers' comp processes to make sure that the injured employees are getting the care they need at the right times and that they get the continuation of care throughout their injury. So I would urge your support in this, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Are there further proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Johnson, J-O-H-N, J-O-H-N, S-O-N. I'm a business agent with the Operating Engineers, Local 400, and we support House Bill 199. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there any further proponents in the audience or in the hall? Any further proponents? Are there proponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, I have Eric Strauss.
Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Strauss, S-T-R-A-U-S-S. I'm the administrator for the Employment Relations Division, Department of Labor and Industry. First off, I'd like just to thank Representative Harvey for bringing this bill on our behalf. He did a really good job, of explaining the tenets of the bill, so I won't go into much more detail. I would add just on the first proposal in terms of sharing non-statutory benefits, just so you know that we already have certain obligations to supply information to injured workers at the time of injury. So we just like to capitalize on that communication to make sure that additional non-statutory benefits are made available to those individuals that are outside of the normal workers' compensation system. There are some good programs out there that are available, and we just want to make sure people are aware of them. The second piece about the reopening, again, is strictly a streamlining process for us. It prevents a lot of paperwork being unnecessarily shared. In the case when there's no dispute, there's nothing we would do additionally with that information anyways. So it will provide a nice streamlining for us. And then the last piece, as was stated, is an entirely redundant process and a liability to insurers that's unnecessary. You know, one of our duties as regulators is to ensure that there's a necessary backdrop for all claimants and all employers in the event of a bankruptcy. We feel that the guarantee association that exists provides ample coverage for that potential. So we would certainly encourage a due pass on this legislation, and I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss. Next proponent online.
Mr. Chair, Peter Strauss.
Peter Strauss.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Peter Strauss, S-T-R-A-U-S-S, and thank you for your indulgence in failing to recognize I spelled my name for the last bill. First, let me clarify that the other Mr. Strauss and I are not related, and regrettably, we've also identified we're not related to that blue jeans guy either. I represent Montana Self-Insurers Association, MSIA. Has a couple of members on the LMAC, and we wholeheartedly support this bill as a good technical cleanup to the laws in the state regarding workers' compensation and its operations. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm available for questions if you need me.
Thank you, Mr. E. Strauss, or P. Strauss. Okay. Are there any further proponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Kevin Braun.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Braun, B-R-A-U-N, with the Montana State Fund, and we rise in support of House Bill 199. In particular, I would point out the section of the bill, Section 2, page 3, lines 24 through 28, that relieves a burden on insurers to provide documentation that isn't going to be used anyway. And it removes an idle act, which helps to streamline the system. The parties have already stipulated a reopening, and it's just unnecessary. So I appreciate the efforts of Representative Harvey to bring the bill and assist in making the system a little more efficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. Are there any further online proponents?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any more on my list, although Al Smith does have their hand raised, but I did not have them on my list, so it would be up to you to add them or not.
Okay, are there any opponents?
Bob Allum, A-L-L-U-M, and I rise, Mr. Chairman, and the committee, to speak neither for nor against the bill, but I am opposed to one portion of the bill. I have already participated in a reopening of a claim, and I can tell you it is a nightmare. And that for all aspects of this bill, I have support with the exception of page 4. It's renumbered 10, lines 1 through 4. It refers any aggrieved party to be able to address their grievance with the Workers' Compensation Court. The Workers' Compensation Court is a myth. In 1975, HB 100 approved the workers' compensation judge as an administrative judge. The Montana Supreme Court in 1976 in Skunk Root versus Gallatin Laundry Company, through judicial fiat, created the Workers' Compensation Court. That has existed until 1989 when 39-71-2901 was amended by adding a subsection 2 called Workers' Compensation Court and delineating district court authorities. Instead of going into the weeds on this, this is a question for the attorneys and the rest. What I want to do is submit, it is a brief that is currently sitting before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that goes into great detail to this, but I will tell you from my perspective, it will be resolved, and I don't want this committee or the legislature blindsided by the fact that a system that has already been claiming to exist doesn't exist constitutionally. And I can answer questions if you want to ask them specifically, or I can give you a general view. But like I say, this is a question for your attorneys. I've worked for legislators in the past, and I know what your slates are like. And I know that this is work that should have been done by the Legislative Counsel Services, but has never been done since 1976. So with that, I'll end, but I would like to submit this for the record.
Go ahead.
Where do I?
He'll pass it down. It's the whole thing. He'll just pass it down, yeah. Thank you.
I've left it loose because I figured it would either be photocopied or scanned.
Thank you, Mr. Allam. Are there any further opponents? Any further opponents? Any online opponents? I don't see any. Questions from the committee? Or informational witnesses, I'm sorry. Informational witnesses. We have two, or do we have any?
Mr. Chair, we have one online, Ethan Heverly.
Mr. Heverly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ethan Heverly with Montana State Fund. That's H-E-V-E-R-L-Y. Happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Heverly. Any further informational witnesses? Seeing none, are there questions now from the committee? Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This be for Mr. Allman.
Mr. Allam.
Allam.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, it's Allam, like if you made pickles, A-L-L-U-M,
Mr.
except
Allam.
I'm double strength.
I have it spelled right. I just don't know how to talk.
Mr. Allam.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Allman, could you cite those numbers that you gave? I kind of like to follow up on what people said, but I couldn't keep up with you.
No problem. That's the reason I gave the brief, because they're all in there, too. But what you've got is in 1975, HB1.
But I'm just referring, you gave us some code numbers, 3.
Okay, 39-71-2901. Specifically, subsection 2 and parts, I believe it's A through D.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Any further questions from the committee? No hands being raised? A lot of smiles? Representative Galloway?
Being you're insisting we have questions.
Has another question.
I came up with another one. Chair Nolan. I guess I would bring this question to... possibly Ethan Heverly.
Mr. Heverly.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize.
To Mr. Galloway.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, Kevin Braun is actually going to testify for us as a proponent.
Redirect.
Mr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway.
Mr. Braun, I'm just curious with the case that's been referenced. Are you familiar with that, and do we have any concerns with the language that is in this bill that we need to address this before we move forward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galloway, I am somewhat familiar with the case that Mr. Allam has referenced, and that's for the judicial system to decide, so I probably won't comment on it, but I do not have concerns over the statute as written.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, would the sponsor like to close on his bill? Representative Harvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you once again for a good hearing. I would just like to state on the record that the section that was outlined, and with much respect to the opposition, is current language in statute. This bill does not make any changes to that section other than renumbering that section. So actually the content and the case study that is around this does not pertain to this bill. This is a great bill. I think the strong work of the LMAC committee needs to be recognized, and I would appreciate a due pass on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Harvey. This concludes the hearing on House Bill number 177. How about on House Bill number 199? Excuse me. Got the wrong one. Okay, we next have the privilege of hearing House Bill number 177. Representative Garner, are the people in the hall coming in, or are we in?
We're good.
We're good. Would you like to open on your bill, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Garner. I'm the representative for House District 7, which is the greater metropolitan Kalispell area, as we all know it. Here today to present House Bill 177 to the committee and to talk a little bit about the importance of integrated behavioral health and some of the impediments that exist, things that are keeping us in our state from doing that. You're going to hear from the proponents today, now that my voice is changing, that there are hundreds of unfilled licensed professional positions in our state. And we're going to talk a little bit about what's keeping us from doing that, and here's the good news. It isn't a bucket of money. It is not because there is not a need, because I think most of us, our eyes will tell us, we don't need to look at a study, that there is a significant need out there for those licensed professional addiction counselors and social workers and others, and we're going to hear more about that from the folks working in the field. The thing that is keeping us from being able to fill those positions is a policy. It's words on a piece of paper that are in the control of this committee and this body. That is one of the big impediments that's keeping us, particularly when we see people move in here from out of state, that we have very restrictive rules in place in terms of what has to be on their resume. And it's not that we're going to change the standard or that we're not going to have qualified people. Again, I think you'll hear from the proponents about that and the need for us to have some flexibility in that as we review those applications from people elsewhere. And we've got a board, we've got professional people that are qualified in that position to make those determinations, and we aren't letting them do it. So if it suits the committee, I won't go into too more detail because you've got some folks in the field that are going to come up and give you some more information on that. but I would ask that you give a due pass on House Bill 177 and that we consider how we could change a few words on a piece of paper and make it much easier for us to provide that professional level of experience in integrated behavioral health in Montana. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garner. Other proponents to House Bill 177?
Good morning, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Stacy Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, and I'm here representing the Montana Primary Care Association today. We are the membership organization for Montana's federally qualified health centers and also four of the state's urban Indian centers. We serve about 122,000 patients every year in 80 locations across the state. Those are typically medically underserved and vulnerable populations, including rural and frontier areas. I think Representative Garner gave a good overview about why this bill is before you today. One of the things I keep thinking about when we look at these licensing bills is that we can't do the work if we don't have the workforce. And this body has been tackling some of these issues over the last couple of sessions around some of the barriers we have to licensing, particularly for applicants who are coming in from out of state. And I do believe there's a proponent online who will sort of, she was the genesis of this bill, sort of her experience in Hamilton, Montana. But at the end of the day, we are competing with 50 other states and territories to bring in qualified applicants for all the work we do on mental health. And when Representative Garner talked about behavioral health, he really is talking about mental health and substance use disorder. And Urban Indian Clinics and FQHCs do an integrated model. So in our primary care settings, we have all of the licenses that are regulated by the Board of Behavioral Health in our employ. We actually employ about 150 behavioral health specialists in the state of Montana, and we have many vacancies currently. Some of them have lasted for over a year. Of our 122,000 patients, 62,000 of them have a diagnosis of some, in some way, of a mental health or substance use disorder. Like, that's half of them, right? And we provided 220,000 behavioral health visits in the average year. So I can't say 2020 because what a kooky year that has been, right, from the medical side. But so we've been working on this bill for a while. We worked over it on the interim. We've worked with the Board of Behavioral Health. They have seen this bill as well. They voted to endorse the bill. I don't believe anyone's able to be on the phone today from the board itself, but I think you have an informational witness as staff. But really looking at the five licenses that are under the Board of Behavioral Health, and this bill tackles four of them. And it's really looking at those barriers in bringing those out-of-state applicants in, because we do have really high standards in Montana. We want to provide really great care to our patients. And a lot of those standards are enumerated in statute. And what this board doesn't have is any rule authority to have flexibility for thinking about equivalency from out-of-state applicants who are maybe missing a degree component or a testing component that is enumerated in our statute. But if they have not done those things, we cannot license them in the state without that board authority to look at equivalency standards. So if someone has 20 years of experience being a licensed addiction counselor in another state, if they're missing one element of the statute in Montana, they either have to go back to school, take a new test, whatever the case may be. So I will walk you through the bill real quickly so you can understand where we thought the hiccups really existed with each of those four licenses. On page one, it addresses the licensed clinical social worker piece, and it's really about the difference in degrees across the states. Licensed clinical social workers and social work in general is a pretty settled license. They've been around the longest of these four licenses that we're looking at today, and there is some innovation going on in those spaces, so that's why we thought if we gave the board permission to think about if there's a piece missing from the degree, do they need to think about some equivalency standards? If you go to page three, we tackle the licensed clinical professional counselor piece. Again, this is also about the credit hours. This is about the degree, how many credit hours are in the degree that they have, making sure that we can think about what are some equivalent standards. In our statute right now, it lists that you have to have a 60 credit hour degree in order to qualify for an LCPC in Montana. LCPCs have huge variation across the state of the states. If you think about 50 states and the territories, they call them something different. They have everything from associates up to masters qualifications, and it's just, this is one of the hiccups that we have in licensing LCPCs in the state of Montana. And then you get to the licensed addiction counselors, even a newer degree, right? Thinking about the work we've done across the state and across the country on addiction in the last 20 years, it is really, it still feels like a new degree for us. So we looked at two pieces for the licensed addiction counselors piece. One is about the degree equivalency, and then also about the testing requirement that is listed in Montana statute, giving the board some authority to be flexible for folks who have a lot of experience to come into the state of Montana. And then finally, for LMFTs, so that's the licensed marriage family therapists, we ask for flexibility around their post-degree experience and degrees. So there's that. And I just wanted, I think Representative Garner mentioned a few things. I wanted to give you a quick snapshot. I looked up on Indeed.com this weekend just to get a sense of what the demand is for these positions in Montana. In Montana, there are 257 open social work positions, 140 open professional counselor positions, and 20 LAC positions in Montana. And you might think, oh, 20, that's not bad, right? I mean, that seems pretty good. But then if you look at the nation, there's 2,500 open LAC positions. So when we're thinking about an out-of-state applicant coming into the state of Montana, we're competing with all of those other states, those 2,500-plus job applications. And if they're hitting a barrier in Montana, they're going to choose to go to Wyoming or the Dakotas or, you know, I don't know why they would choose that, but that's what we're running into in our state. So this rule authority is permissive. The board may choose not to establish these equivalency standards, right? They may say, no, we really want this degree requirement. This is the standard we want to maintain for the state of Montana. But this allows them to think about what they're running into when they're licensing individuals. If for those of you who were here in 2019, you might recall House Bill 105. That bill actually helped streamline a lot of licensing for out-of-state applicants. It established a more streamlined process for individuals coming in from states that are substantially equivalent to the state of Montana. And this bill just builds on that, right? So we still have a number of states, particularly for LACs and LCPCs, where those equivalency standards are not substantially similar. So we keep having those problems with licensing. I'm happy to answer more questions about that. With the chair's indulgence, Matt Kuntz from NAMI Montana had hoped to be here today in support of the bill, and he got hung up at the office. So thank you very much, and I urge a due pass on House Bill 177. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Are there further proponents? Are there further proponents in the audience? Seeing none, are there proponents online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, we have Janet Woodburn.
Thank you, Chairman Nolan and committee, and for the opportunity to address you today. I'm one of the folks from the field who's been struggling with this issue, and I'd like to drill down just a little bit further.
Do you want to just spell your name for us?
Woodburn, sorry, Woodburn. I'm the CEO at Sapphire Community Health. It's a nonprofit community health center located in Ravalli County, Montana. So community health centers, we provide physical health, medical services, mental health, and substance abuse disorder treatment to our communities. And quite simply, to summarize my testimony, there just simply are not enough mental health and substance abuse professionals for us to meet the demand for services. And yet, when we do have a mental health or substance abuse disorder professional from other states apply to Montana for reciprocity, we're turning many of them away, and we're denying licensure to seasoned professionals. And that's where I want to emphasize: we're not trying to lessen the requirements, but these are seasoned professionals who are licensed in other states. Many of them have, and I've personally interviewed people with 10, 15, 20 years experience in licensure in the state where they're currently residing and they're wanting to come to Montana, but we deny their licensure application because years ago, 20 years ago when they were in college, they didn't take a particular course. So we deny, what we do is we tell them that if they want licensure, they can go back to college. It's typical that we require that they go for a full year back to college, which many professionals who I've interviewed and tried to recruit have simply decided not to do. And as Stacy mentioned, there's other states who are recruiting these people as well. But when you think about it, if this were your family member, who would you want them, who would you want your family member to have as a therapist? Someone who is fresh out of college, newly licensed, and has met all of our educational requirements, or someone who's worked in the field for 15 years? Because I can tell you that 15 years of experience is worth far more than the educational requirements that we're requiring. Not that those aren't important, but we are we're in a crisis in Montana, and maybe the rest of the country. I can't speak to that, but our statistics in Montana are staggering. We still lead the country in suicides. We go from first to second or third, but we've never dropped lower than third in the country for the number of suicides in Montana. The number of methamphetamine-related crimes has increased 100%. Of all the Montana child removals for abuse and neglect, 68% are for parental drug use. And these numbers, and I could go on and on with these numbers, and I won't, but these are all pre-COVID, because COVID has exacerbated all of these factors. Suicide, depression, anxiety, and substance abuse has gone off the charts in the last year. We're desperate. we need some flexibility in these standards, and we're not prescriptive. We're asking that the Board of Behavioral Health be empowered to substitute years of experience for lack of coursework. And in closing, I'm just going to say, and why I am so passionate about this is, just in the last several months, Sapphire Community Health in Ravalli County has been asked to provide mental health and substance use disorder therapists to our local hospital, to three different school districts in our county, and to the district drug court. That's five new people that they want us to bring into the schools, the hospital, and the courts. And we would love to do it. We know how to do this work. We're very good at doing this work. Our problem is that we can't find the licensed professionals to fill these positions. So for that reason, we're asking that you give this Bill 177 your greatest attention, and thank you for allowing me to comment. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Woodburn. Next proponent online, please.
Jean Branscombe.
Ms. Branscombe.
Good morning, members of the committee, and thank you, Chairman Noland, and members, for giving me this chance to speak on behalf of the Montana Medical Association. I am Jean Branscombe, that's B-R-A-N-S-C-U-M, and I am the CEO of the Montana Medical Association. The Montana Medical Association is the organization that advocates on behalf of physicians. We have about 1,400 members, and we also are an essential voice for our patients. We want to extend our appreciation to Representative Garner for bringing this bill forward and to offer, again, our support. I also want to give a thank you shout out to the Primary Care Association for the work they've done over the interim to find solutions to an ongoing issue surrounding the need for additional workforce in these particular areas. You know, what we like about the bill is, one, physicians, as you just heard from the prior testimony, note that there is a real void and a gap in the amount of workforce needed to address the needs that are out there, and those needs have grown since the COVID pandemic. What we like about the bill is that it really takes a look at the board that is charged with regulating this profession and gives them the flexibility to do what they think is best. You know, our professional regulatory boards are given the charge to protect patient safety, to protect public safety in what they do, and those board members take that role extremely seriously. So we have faith and trust in the Board of Behavioral Health to take charge of this flexibility, do what they believe is in the best interest of the public and the profession, and have the flexibility to adopt rules surrounding what they believe is right. So with that, we encourage a do pass.
Thank you, Ms. Bronscombe. Are there, do we have one more online proponent?
Mr. Chair, it looks like both of the other proponents are not present on the call.
Okay. Any further proponents? Seeing none, are there opponents to House Bill 177? Any opponents? Any opponents online? Seeing none, are there informational witnesses? Online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Lucy Richards.
Good morning, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Lucy Richards, and I am the Executive Officer for the Board of Behavioral Health, Department of Labor and Industry, and I am available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Are there any further informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Vice Chair Buttrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Anderson, please.
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Nolan, Vice Chair Buttrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Anderson, you may have said this, but this is affecting four of the five types of licensees in the section, and maybe you said it before, but what is the fifth?
Chair Nolan, Vice Chair Buttrey, the fifth license overseen by the Board of Behavioral Health are the Certified Behavioral Health Peer Support Specialists. And so that certification came to be 4 years ago in the Montana Legislature. This body approved that new certification, and so far we have not heard of challenges for that particular certification.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson. So we don't have statute written for those other licensees similar to this that we should address, even though we don't need it now, but that section of law is fine without these same changes?
So, Chair Nolan, Vice Chair Buttrey, I just haven't heard of challenges getting those folks certified other than there were some hiccups getting that certification up and running when it first was approved. I'm certainly happy to look at that and see if there's any challenges, but it doesn't, I would have to look at it again. I don't want to misspeak at the podium.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? No hand waving. No thumbs up. Okay. Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might digress just a little bit, but a question for Lucy Richards.
Ms. Richards.
Yes, Chair Nolan, Representative Galloway.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, Ms. Richards. I know this bill does a great job, I think, and just brings to mind of an experience we've encountered with psychiatrists and psychologists. Do you think it's possible to draft any legislation to help it make it easier to get some of those folks licensed? We had a recent experience of a gentleman in the Air Force at Great Falls that wanted to retire, wanted to stay here, and of course he could get licensed because of the time, but as I understand it, a psychiatrist needs multiple psychologists to work with him, and he ran into roadblocks there, and he ended up moving back to Utah, and we lost another good professional. Could you maybe take a minute and share with us what we might could do?
Mr. Chair, those fixes would not fit under the title of this bill, unfortunately.
Representative Gardner.
If I can, Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe there is a bill that Senator Small is carrying that addresses your specific concern.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, would the distinguished gentleman who used to carry a gun like to close on his bill?
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Although I took social work in college because they promised there'd be no math, I became a policeman instead of a social worker because they said I could carry a gun. So I'm here today to tell you that, you know, we've got tens of thousands of Montanans, right? That's the testimony we heard today, tens of thousands that need our help. And the one of the things that's keeping us from doing it is being able to put qualified people out there. It's not that there isn't jobs. It's not that there's people that don't want to do it. We're not supplanting Montana jobs. We can't fill them in such a critical area, right? And again, I think this one is the eyeball test. I think all of us can look out in our communities and know that we need this additional help. And if we change a few words on a piece of paper and get out of their way and let them do their work, I believe we'll be able to help solve this problem. That's my ask for the committee. Do pass on House Bill 177. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. This concludes the hearing on House Bill number 177. For members, I believe we already have the account. I just want to remind you about the dinner tonight. Those that were invited, we're taking some, and we're taking some others at different times. Have you responded to our vice chair? So just remind that we do have that dinner tonight at Silver Star at 6. Okay. All right. With that, if there's no other questions from the committee or concerns, is oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for waving. Someone saw you. Representative Olson has a comment, brief comment.
Thank you. Yes, it'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing me a moment of personal privilege to apologize to you, Mr. Chairman, the committee, to Representative Ricky, who brought House Bill 117. When we did executive action, I was I was thinking we were on a different bill, and I spoke against House Bill 117 and voted against it. And members of the committee, I believe Representative Ricky's bill on behalf of the auditor's office is a fine bill, and I will be voting for it. I would change my vote. I don't think that's allowed, is it, Chairman Nolan?
No.
Okay, well, I just wanted to apologize for the committee for stating inaccurate opposition, because I think I said I felt it did something. I do believe this bill is an improvement for the people of Montana, and thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman Nolan and members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. With that being said, remember the apologies are always welcome in this committee. With that, business and labor is adjourned.